The Batteries Included podcast is brought to you with United Chargers and their Grizzly range. The next generation of Grizzly is here. Meet the Grizzly Ultimate, the most powerful AC level 2 charger for home use. With a maximum current of 80 amps, that's 19.2 kilowatts, your vehicle could be charged up to twice as fast as a standard level 2 and up to 15 times faster than a level 1. And of course, it's Wi-Fi connected, so you can take control of your home charging, view stats, set a charging schedule, take part in demand response programs, and control your charger remotely. And that joins the lineup alongside the original Grizzly Classic. The Grizzly Duo, designed to charge two vehicles at the same time. The Grizzly Mini, a portable charging station. And the Grizzly Smart, a revolutionary smart EV charger. Those chargers can adjust the current from 16 amps up to 40 amps, that's 9.6 kilowatts. Plus, the Grizzly Ranger IP67 rated, built in Canada, and with the highest quality materials, you can order yours right now. Go to unitedchargers.com, that's unitedchargers.com.
Well, hello and welcome to the Batteries Included podcast for Friday, the November 29th show, episode 65. Today we'll be talking about Scout Motors, Traveller and Terror with the company's head of product marketing. Not here now, but he will be here later. California Governor Gavin Newsom suggesting the state may offer a new EV incentive themselves if the incoming administration kills the current one. And Rivian receiving a $6.6 billion loan from the federal government. And of course, much, much more. I'm your host, Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast. Joining us today is the newly crowned king of YouTube. Watch out, Mr. Beast, because Mr. Tom Mulogany has got his first, the first of many plaques on the wall. Senior editor at Inside EVs, host of the YouTube channel State of Charge, and now with over 100,000 subscribers. Go watch Tom's short video for that. We also have Dominic Yoni, a longtime EV journalist and host of the YouTube channel Drive Electric with Dominic. And in about an hour's time at 10:30 Eastern, we'll be joined by Scout Motors head of product marketing, Shaheen Karamian. Now, first of all, I hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving yesterday. Whatever you are up to, we can see Tom is on the road right now. I imagine traveling with family. We're very glad to have you with us during this holiday weekend. So, Tom, congratulations. Big moment. You got the old YouTube plaque on the wall. Congrats.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, I talked about it, I think, a couple of weeks ago that I had just hit that milestone, 100,000 subscribers. And when you do that, YouTube, if you want it, they offer a plaque and, they send an email and I responded, yes, please. I'll take my silver play button plaque. And I just got it 2 days ago. So I did a little YouTube short thanking the subscribers, because honestly, it's all about you guys. I'm making the content, but if you're not subscribing, the numbers aren't piling up. And then I stopped doing this stuff. So I just wanted to thank everybody on Thanksgiving. It was an appropriate day to say, look, I'm doing this because you guys are subscribing and watching the videos. And I really appreciate everyone that subscribes and watches my videos. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to watch you to grow that over the years as well. Already at 101,000 last time I looked. Now, before we get into the news, Tom, you put a video out this week of a hands-on look at the GM Energy vehicle-to-home system. You and Dominic also recorded a special show in a channel. Listeners and viewers can find it with GM's Energy Asim Kapoor about the home energy system. This video with Derek Sequoia. Between these two videos, and of course, you've gone through the process yourself with the Ford Home Backup Power System, you know more than most about this. So what does the average EV owner need to know about this system from GM?
So it's, to put it really simple, the systems are expensive. And currently, you know, I think personally, there's not a lot of people that are going to be, that this is going to make economic sense for it. Now, I know that sounds terribly negative, but they're the first generation of these systems. And for some people, if you can do energy arbitrage, meaning you can charge your batteries from electricity from the grid when there's low cost time of use plans and so forth, and then use that when it's high, then it really becomes economically viable. But I think for the average person, Martin, that just wants it to have home energy backup in case there's a power outage, unless you live in an area where there's a lot of power outages and you don't have access to, say, natural gas, because the least expensive way of really powering your house during emergencies is a natural gas, like a whole home generator. And it's always there. It's you don't need to have the vehicle parked in your driveway. You know, when you leave your home in a day during a power outage, it's still there. So that's still the most efficient or best cost effective way of powering your house. But you know, what I keep going back to is the fact that I do believe that these vehicle to home and vehicle to grid systems, as well as the vehicles being able to have that capability, are the future of electric vehicles. And we have to start somewhere. And I said this about the Ford system, that look, it was Ford's first effort. It was a good first effort. It's an expensive system. I don't think a lot of people it makes sense for. So for some people, it does. I kind of feel the same way about the GM system. GM system is very similar to the Ford system. It's got three main components: the inverter, the hub that GM calls it, which is the part that maybe that islands the home during a power outage. It's the disconnect, and then the dark start battery, which you see the gray square box if you're watching on YouTube. At the bottom of the screen, that's a little battery that when there is a power outage, momentarily there needs some sort of something to power the whole system to communicate with the vehicle and then start power flow. And that's what the dark start battery does. So this is very similar to Ford's system. And then of course, all the way to the left on your screen, you'll see GM's energy shift charger, which is an 80 amp bidirectional charger, very similar to Ford's Charge Station Pro, which is an 80 amp bidirectional charger that uses a CCS1 connector for charging on AC, but then discharging back to the home. You need the DC pins. So it's similar, very similar system to Ford's. It costs more than Ford's system, but GM is currently running some really good specials. And if you combine it with home energy storage, which GM offers that Ford doesn't, which if you're watching on YouTube, you'll see me and Derek standing right in front of two of the power banks that they have. They sell them in 10 kilowatt hour versions and also 17.5 kilowatt hour versions. So you could actually stack two of them next to each other as we have in this demonstration, and you've got 35 kilowatt hour of home energy storage. You know, if you go for the trifecta and combine that with solar electric at your house, you pretty much are good to go no matter what happens. But it's expensive. And that's, you know, I can't wait for the day that we can have something like this for $1,000 or $2, you know, and you come home, plug your truck in, and, you know, that's all it costs. Then you can power your house. You can do energy arbitrage where you could, you know, charge your car battery up overnight from cheap grid electricity. And then during the day, let's say you work at home, use your truck to power your whole house. I keep saying truck. This is going to be for all electric vehicles. Like GM right now has, I think, 6 or 7 vehicles currently on sale. I think it's 6 currently on sale that have the bidirectional power flow capability. And 2 more are coming with the Cadillac brand. That's the Cadillac vehicles that are going to be hitting the market soon. Mm-hmm. So GM's gonna have like 8 vehicles already out there, and they're not all trucks, that have this bidirectional power flow capability. And I wholeheartedly, Martin, believe it's the future of the industry. And these systems are just the first versions of what we're getting.
Yeah, mine's 10 kilowatt hours or so. And mm-hmm. I've got the SolarEdge panels, but I've got the optimizers behind the panels. They're not micro inverters, they're optimizers. And then they feed the SolarEdge inverter, and then that will send DC direct with no conversion, no losses, no inefficiencies. It goes DC from my panels to my battery. And then if I need that, then of course, got to go through a DC-AC conversion, which is, you know, leads to some inefficiencies. But 10 kilowatt hours does me just fine. We have a three to four bedroom house. And, you know, with a family with 2 young children in a northern climate where even today, it's a pretty cold November day, it's still blue skies and sunny. I think I'm still generating 1.5 kilowatts right now from the roof. Again, it's peaky this time of year. I'm only going to get some generation maybe between 11 and 1 perhaps, or 11 and 2 in the afternoon, if I'm lucky on a good day. But that's all you really need. And I really use the battery for charging up overnight when I pay 7 pence, not 26 pence per kilowatt hour per unit. And that does me absolutely fine. Would I like more? Probably. Yeah. I mean, look, I paid, was it £7,000 or £9,000? I forget actually, which is a huge amount of money for that. It was a couple of years ago now. And, I can't get away from that. That is a lot of money. Now in my head, I can amortize that over the, we're not moving. We're going to be here for a long time. We're between two great schools, probably here for the next 10, 12 years, if not longer, in this house. So we can justify that investment in investing in the property. But for many people, that's a big leap. That's a big jump. So, that's pricing coming down, like you say, is going to be very, very important. And then vehicle to home and vehicle to grid, how our cars integrate with that, will be very interesting. If you have occasional power cuts, please don't get a battery just for an occasional power cut. Just find a way to get through that period of time, either with some sort of generator, you know, like Tom says. But yeah, I got the same here as same as you've got, and it's very, very useful to be able to access stuff when you have a power cut. Now let's move on. We've been talking a little bit about
Martin. Let me just interject 1 second. Sorry. So John Check, one of our loyal followers, just is pointing out that it's the future for people with deep pockets. Ooh. And John, I just want you to think about where we are today, and that's not where we're going to be, 10 years from now, as far as costs of these items. It's very expensive now, that's correct. But don't forget, when electric vehicles first came out, the batteries were unreasonably expensive. It's part of the reason why many of the automakers said, we'll never do this, because it's just prohibitively expensive. The first car I had was an electric Mini Cooper. I was in BMW's pilot program. I had a little 35 kilowatt hour battery, somewhere around there. The battery alone cost almost $50,000 for like 33 kilowatt hour. That same battery or same size battery today would be like $10,000-$12,000. So, you can't look through today's glasses, John, and say, the future, for rich people, that's not going to be the case. The prices are going to come down. And that's why I made it a point when I first started talking about this, to talk about the fact that these are first generation systems that Ford and GM's putting out. They're a little bit clunky. They are expensive, but they're kind of like science projects and learning experiences for these companies. And we don't get to the second and third and fourth generation products without the first generation. And I know we all wish we could have that today, but we are where we're at right now. But I'm pretty confident, 10 years from now, you're going to be able to have some sort of a home, vehicle to home system with electric vehicles at a much lower price point than what we're seeing today.
Hey, Tom, I was just thinking, are these like NCM or what's the chemistry in these GM energy batteries?
Yeah, we didn't get into the cell.
Okay, but I don't think it's LFP though, right?
No, it should be.
It would make sense. It should be LFP, right? Because I don't know. We didn't get into that.
Yeah, right. NCM in the Solar Edge. It's crazy. The little cylindrical NCM cells. I think they're the ones that go inside. Either way, what a crazy chemistry. I actually have it in my garage, which is a detached building from my house. And if it was an LFP pack, I'd probably have it somewhere in the house. But I made them do a long cable run out to the garage. And I'm involved in this world day in, day out. And I know how safe they are. But even then, I'm like, really? NCM cells in the home storage? Okay, well, that's going in the garage just because I don't want any. It's got a fire extinguisher inside it. There's no problem. That's a very, very safe system that I've got. But still, I was like, why not LFP? Weird. Anyway, it seems like a more expensive solution. Maybe it's a couple of years ago, but still. All right, hey, we should move on. We've got a lot to get to today. Let's talk about EV tax credits, because certain states, it could be that the next 4 years, depending on where you live in the US, depends on whether you get a federal a tax credit. As the federal one will be going away, we think the new incoming Republican White House have said that they will prioritize killing the federal tax credit, and it will slow down the transition to electric vehicles in some parts of the US for some parts of, some demographics as well, particularly relying on those incentives to get into an EV. It's just going to have huge implications for the automakers and suppliers as well, have invested many billions in setting up factories for EVs and batteries. Many of these jobs created in so-called red states. Now, California suffers from very poor air quality in many of their cities because of internal combustion vehicles. So, of course, they lead the way in terms of getting onto EV. Governor Gavin Newsom who I looked at the betting markets this week. As you know, I love American politics, even though I'm thousands of miles away. Absolutely adore looking at, you know, just the way that you run your country. And hey, if I lived there, I'm sure I'd be a little bit more on edge, but still, from a distant observer, I love it. Look at the betting markets. Governor Gavin Newsom, currently the leading candidate to run for the White House in 2028 from the Democratic Party. A lot to happen in the next 4 years. He said this week that he would propose creating a new version of the Clean Vehicle Rebate Program. That was phased out in 2023. Unclear what the amounts would be. Previously, $2,500 could be more. Tesla would be excluded from it as well because of the cap that they would put on that. The governor's office said any exclusions would promote more market competition. The Tesla CEO, Elon Musk, took to social media to say that Tesla is the only company who makes their EVs in California. This is insane, he said. So, is this a political motivation? Is it an early White House play? Is it for the hard-working people who live in that state who just need a bit of help to get into an EV? Dominic, what do you think about this story?
I don't know, it certainly looks like first of all, I like the idea of California stepping up and replacing a federal, you know, incentive if it goes away, because California has a lot at stake. You know, like you mentioned, they have, because of the just the number of vehicles in there. I mean, it's a heavily populated state. They have a lot of cars, have a big car culture, but they also have this sort of over like San Francisco and I believe LA, they have like these air inversions where smog gets trapped over the cities and it makes, you know, for terrible air quality, and you know, which leads to asthma and heart disease and all those kinds of things. So they really want to see, you know, fewer gas combustion cars and more EVs. So it makes sense for them to offer, you know, incentives, especially if there's the big federal one that's kind of moving things along at the current rate goes away. Then, you know, their willingness to step up, I think, is encouraging. The excluding Tesla, I think, is a bit of it feels like a political move to me. I'm not sure if I don't think it's a good idea, really. I mean, I get it, you know, and Musk is very happy to see the federal incentive go away because it hurts, you know, hurts other automakers more than it would hurt him, right? So he's not really hung up on the federal incentive at all. But he didn't like the idea of being excluded from this one for some reason. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Tom? Or you're on mute there.
Sorry. So yeah, I wouldn't be in favor of excluding Tesla or singling out Tesla for this. I mean, if you wanted to single out automakers, which I probably am against entirely, but if, let's say, they were going to go along that route, I would single out, I would exclude all the automakers that actively lobby against tax incentives and tax credits, and there's a list of them. And you know, that would be the way to go, rather than just, you know, eliminate the tax credit for Tesla, let's say, in particular, single one company out. You know, it's hard. I've always thought that there should be income limits on the incentives and price limits, like they imposed when they redid the EV tax credit. I don't really like the way they did it, but I could see incentivizing the lower cost. If California wanted to do something, let's say the tax credit does go away and California really wants to incentivize, I could see them bringing it back to specifically incentivize the very low cost electric vehicles. I'd definitely be in favor of that. I'm in favor of eliminating EV tax incentives, just not right now. I think we just need another 2 or 3 years, and we could take the training wheels off. I'm definitely not for long-term incentives like this, but individual states, if they want to have their own incentives, I would really look hard at the income limits and the cost of the vehicles. That would be how I would exclude vehicles, not exclude individual automakers because, you know, their CEO maybe lobbied against the tax credit or has some more pull than some of the other CEOs. There's a lot of companies doing a lot behind the scenes to slow down electric vehicle adoption. You don't have to look further than Toyota. Toyota's probably done more to try to hold back electric vehicle adoption and spent more money lobbying government officials to not have tax incentives. So, you know, if California were going to, let's say, exclude Tesla, they better darn well exclude Toyota. Because, you know, while Elon's got a lot of bluster and we see him in the news all the time, there's a lot of other companies that have been doing a lot of bad things that maybe we don't hear about as much as we hear about from Elon, because he owns a major news outlet now.
Yeah, it's a good shout. Trying to find out how much the tax credit spending has been this year. I think they just hit $2 billion. I got the numbers here for April 24. The U.S. Treasury Department reimbursed $1 billion to dealers who offer the tax credit, and that was in April. I think we've hit over $2 billion now. I think we must have done by now. Right. And that is the headline that I think people get very upset about. So I agree with Tom. I would take it away. I would happily see that gone. Easy for me to say, I know, from this position of comfort that I sit in here, but I would take away any federal level free money, as it were, seen as, mm-hmm. and then you depoliticize it. Now, that's $2 billion that's been handed to people via the dealers, point of sale, tax credit. That is an order of magnitude different to the hundreds of billions that the Inflation Reduction Act has had, has inspired investment from both US and foreign businesses to invest on US soil. We talk about battery factories, manufacturing, supply chains. That was the essence of the IRA, the increasing ramping up of how much domestic materials had to be in the batteries on the 1st of January every year. It's 60% now, goes to 70% non-China or bad countries. And so that all happens in the background and no one cares. No one cares about that. It can't be made a political issue. The average voter in the US doesn't want to bother their life about understanding the intricacies of the IRA. So, as you know, that, and that's a shame, because the so-called free money that your neighbor is getting for their fancy new electric vehicle, and you don't get it for your diesel or petrol truck, that's not fair. I sympathize with that opinion, and that's why it was able to be politicized in the recent election, and why people feel strongly about it. I agree with Tom. Get rid of that. Let all the stuff happen in the background, which I suspect will continue. I think if you try and take that away, it's just going to get tied up in the courts forever. Because if I'd invested tens of billions in the promise of this is the direction we're going, and then someone goes, oh, we're changing it all now. Like, it's easier to get rid of certain things like the lease loophole and what have you. And then the way that we've done it in the UK, we've copied Norway, the way that, who is doing it now? Spain or France just did the similar thing, which is to just not do any kind of free money on EVs, because that gets negative headlines, but just to tax carbon. So we're doubling our tax on plug-in hybrids. We're doubling the tax on petrol and diesel cars from the beginning of next tax year to the beginning of April next year. And so that's the way Norway did it, which was, yes, you can have a petrol or diesel car. It's going to cost you a load more money rather than just kind of this free cash giveaway, which is controversial. So that's what I would do anyway. It seems it's worked for Norway, works for many countries. It's not as obvious, not as quick, doesn't feel as good as a buyer, but still. So let's see where that goes. Not been reading the comments as I've been talking. Not had it open on the same screen, but hopefully you're having a good time in the chat. If you're watching the show live, you're listening to us after the event, you know, we are live here 9:30 Eastern every Friday morning. And the live chat, which some weeks I get to read comment by comment, some I don't, but it's always so good. Thank you so much for joining in with that. So I learned so much from our listeners.
Sorry, Martin. I like to always remind everybody about what Bruce is talking about here, getting back to oil subsidies should definitely be part of the discussion. You know, it's so amazing to me that people get so upset over tax credits that go to individuals, that go to people buying cars. And they don't care that we give away trillions of dollars or hundreds of billions of dollars to these giant oil conglomerates that have billions in profits every quarter. And yet, you know, nobody seems to care about that. Like, but they care that their neighbor got $7,000 off his new car, but they don't care that the rich oil CEO that has, you know, two private jets and three yachts, you know, just got $100 million, you know, incentive to explore oil off the coast of Alaska or something. You know, I guess it's because they don't see that. You know, they see that guy's car next to him in the driveway next door, and that upsets them, that they think that, you know, that he's getting something for free. Yet let's do away with all of it. You know, let's kill the EV tax credit and kill all oil subsidies. You want to save some money, Elon, your Doge department, which I don't even know if they could even do that. The Congress has to create new departments. The president can't create a federal department. You know, but do that. Eliminate all oil subsidies. You see how you know the Republican donors that pull all the oil string, the oil lobby strings, feel about that. But that's what I would do. Get rid of the EV tax credit. Get rid of all oil subsidies.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a very popular. Yeah. By the look of the comments, very very popular opinion.
I think that would be that would be great. I don't see, you know, oil companies get that money because they fund political parties. They dish out that money, you know, quite liberally.
Yeah. And we shouldn't be giving them money. We should be asking for money back to do the cleanup, yeah, to remove the carbon.
Not even
to
asking.
Repair the damage that they're doing. it should be the opposite. It should be like there should be a flow of money, the opposite direction of the money. Yeah. But hey. And, you know, kind of staying with a similar topic, sort of a bit tied up in politics. Before the current lot leave, they have rushed through a $6.6 billion loan from the Advanced Technology Vehicles Manufacturing Loan Program. And this may have been on track anyway, but it seems like they put this through before January 20th. The announcement made this week means that Rivian can restart work on their planned factory in Georgia. This is not free money, by the way. I saw it reported. Someone said, I can't believe they've given Rivian $6 billion. They haven't given Rivian $6 billion. They have loaned Rivian the money to get their planned factory in Georgia. This money will go to Georgia, which will create jobs, and the money will be paid back, as Tesla paid back all of their loans as well, saying it plans to make the R2 and the R3 in Georgia. Those plans are back on track. That Georgia factory, which was on, then off, now it's on again. It's not a done deal. However, this loan, there's some red tape to get through. However, we hope that goes ahead, because that would be very big news for Rivian this week, supporting the auto industry, which of course the incoming Republicans say that they, you know, they do fully. So let's hope they do carry on supporting the auto industry. Big deal for Rivian that Georgia factory was, you know, part of the growing pains. That's why they call them pains, because they are growing pains at Rivian. You know, very well funded, but also very expensive thing to launch those vehicles. So that's got to be great news. And you know, lots of people are very excited about the R2 and the R3 as well. So let's hope those vehicles, they were going to be made in Illinois anyway, normal. But, you know, a new factory, if there's the demand there, they'll make more vehicles, which I think is great news.
I 100% support this. I 100% support giving low interest loans to the domestic automakers, and even the automakers from other countries, if they're going to invest in factories and build manufacturing plants here in the U.S., that's how China really has gotten ahead of us and ahead of the industry with electric vehicle manufacturing. You know, you're a Chinese car company and you want to build a new plant somewhere to build electric vehicles. Sure. Where do you want it? How big do you want the plant? How much money do you need? Here you go. And that's how they've done it. And you look at what China has done in the last 5 years, the companies could not have done it without government help, without the government giving them large plots of land, assisting them, super low interest loans, building factories for them. You know, I know we can't model ourselves over how China runs their government and their businesses. We're different here, but this industry's, it's too important for the U.S. to cede. And I'm all for offering, you know, public money to the automakers to build plants here, to build electric vehicles, to build batteries, you know, lithium refineries, you know, anything to do with this industry, because it's the future of this industry. I know some people disagree with that, but we are going to transition to electric vehicles. Maybe not the people listening here today. I think you guys, many of you would agree. But the U.S. auto manufacturing and the U.S. auto industry is going to be in rough times are ahead if we don't plant the seeds now and invest in the factories here in the U.S. because we'll lose this industry. We know we've said it here a lot, but it's going to happen if we don't do things like this and help the automakers, because the other governments are helping the automakers there. We need to also.
Yeah. The head of Ford UK, Lisa Brankin, is the chair and CEO or MD of Ford UK, did a bit of a media tour this week on our big talk shows in the morning. I mean, like the news media, BBC Radio 4 and things like that. And Ford are pushing very, very hard against the UK's EV percentage of new sales, which is 22% this year, because Ford are one of the companies that aren't going to hit it. They're not going to hit 22%, because what have they got for sale here? The Mustang Mach-E, that's a very good car, but isn't pushed over here, and the sales are very tepid on that. They've got the new Explorer, which is not worthy of the Explorer name, but it's what it's called, which is an ID4, let's face it, with a really cool portrait screen and the interior. I love Ford's interior, but it's a VW, it's the MEB platform. It's part of the tech sharing deal that Ford have done for VW to use Ford's commercial vehicle tech in their vehicles. And the Capri, which they lean very heavily into, saying the legend returns, the Capri is back. And if the Capri means nothing to a few people listening and watching, Capri was legendary, 70s and 80s. It was an icon on TV. Our neighbors had one in, you know, white with a black vinyl roof. It was the 3-liter engine. And that was like the whole street just wanted to go for a ride in that car. The Capri was legendary. The new Capri is the Explorer with a fastback style. Like all the panels, like the door panels are identical. The mirrors are identical. So it shares all the bits with the Explorer. It's basically the Ford ID5. And so, of course, when you're coming to the market over here with vehicles that cost, you know, £50,000 or £55,000, and it's a Mustang Mach-E or a Ford Explorer, which is an ID4, or a Capri, which is the same car with a little bit longer and a fastback, and then you're complaining to the UK government, well, Ford aren't going to hit the 22% they needed to this year, therefore, please change the rules of the game because they're going to be fined. As Tom says, it's not endgame in the slightest, but it's dire straits for big Ford companies like Ford, because until now, they have done killer business with cars like the Fiesta, with the Mondeo. You know, Ford are such a long way from the legendary state. I grew up in the early 90s with fast Fords on my bedroom wall. I didn't want to have a Lamborghini Countach. I wanted a big Ford XR with a big wing on the back of it. Like, that was everyday cars that if you worked really hard, you could, you know, you're never going to get a Lamborghini or a Ferrari, but you might get a fast Ford if you work hard, you know, when you grow up. And my passion for fast Fords, I love that brand so much. They got nothing on sale here that is of any interest, really. To, I could say they're all just okay. Like, two of them are VWs anyway.
Do you get the Mach-E Rally over there?
What's that?
Do you get the Mach-E Rally over there?
I don't know. But it's going to be massively expensive. We have import taxes.
Yeah, for sure.
Pay.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, man. And so Ford are really struggling. And we need to support the industry. And what are you up against? Up against cheap cars from the likes of SAIC, and which is China. Like, you can call it SAIC, but it's China, right? It is literally China, that company. And as Tom says, money is available, incentives are available, anything is available. They're going to have a 45% tariff on their vehicles they sell in Europe, EU, not the UK, because we're out because of Brexit now. And they will still be able to sell those vehicles cheaper than the competition. It's crazy. Anyway, the big car companies are not on borrowed time, but it's serious. It's serious business. If anyone is watching or listening to this, and, you know, as Tom says, this is some serious stuff they're going through. Did anyone see the Nissan news this week in the Financial Times? They quoted a senior Nissan executive to say, we urgently need capitalized funding. They need to get funding from banks or institutions, as Renault is looking to get out of that relationship. I think they hold 35%. And they've got 12 to 14 months.
Nissan is so much in trouble. Oh my God.
I read that in the FT this week. The Financial Times, very, very reputable publication. They're not going to just do clickbait. 12 to 14 months. Nissan have got to survive. And they'll find investors. Of course they will. It's Nissan. This is some serious stuff the car industry is going through. Don't throw it all away, America.
We've been saying this transition to EVs is going to be a painful, bloody transition. You know, everybody wants everything to be nice and smooth and just business as usual, but that's not going to be the case. The next 10 years is going to be a bloodbath in this industry, and people are going to blame it on EVs and say, see, EVs killed Nissan or killed Jaguar or killed whatever. And that's not the case. Poor planning and poor management is what's going to kill these companies, because there's going to be plenty of companies that survive and flourish. The ones that recognize where the industry is going and time things correctly are going to do fine, but the other companies aren't gonna. And we're going to see big name companies go out of business in the next decade. It's going to happen.
And Nissan is like right at the top of that list, you know, like uncertainty, which is a shame because they had so much going on. And I feel like this all was happened after, you know, there was some professional jealousies about having Carlos Ghosn as the CEO of Nissan, you know, and I'm not sure if keeping it Carlos would have, you know, changed the trajectory of things a little bit, but I really do think that they needed to. A lot of it's a cultural thing with the Japanese with the Nissan. You know, they're very proud of their company and their country, and they want to keep that company very Japanese. And allying with Renault and becoming and getting those bonds, you know, becoming really tight. You know, really more integrated with Renault and the other partner in that,
Mitsubishi,
right? There should have been product flowing back and forth. There's a lot of potential to save a lot of money, and they're just too uncomfortable with it. And then I feel like that's what's really kind of coming back to bite them at this point, because then, you know, the management didn't really focus on great product. You know, especially their EV product was pretty skimpy, and I don't know, Aria is pretty much all they have right now, you know, and it's a shame because they were like one of the pioneers of, you know, the lithium electric car. So yeah, I have a feeling they're not going to make it personally. I've always had the feeling they're going to be the first like big one to fall.
But wouldn't that be crazy, the maker of the Nissan Leaf to, you know, just not
pretty
be
sad,
you know, not be around. Super sad. And if you want to talk about how to lean into retro, look at their partner, their former partner, again, Renault, who's looking to get out of Nissan and reduce their share. Renault 5, Renault 4 and Renault 5, particularly the Renault 5. That's how you lean into retro. You don't make a massive SUV that's, you know, taller than most average height people and call it the Capri and want to lean into 70s, 80s nostalgia, but really it's the Ford ID5. Look at what Renault did with the Renault 5 and the Renault 4, particularly the 5. Like, that's going to be a very, very affordable 20-something thousand-pound vehicle that is just full of personality, really amazing technology inside it. You know, vehicle to grid-enabled, ready to go, and just awesomeness. Well done, Renault. And Nissan are missing out on that. Anyway, let's move on. Talk about cars, should we?
Yeah, let's talk about some cars.
New Audi e-tron is out to match the new Taycan. The Taycan got a big refresh recently to its powertrain earlier this year. And now the Audi RS e-tron, which it shares the platform with, J1 platform, 800 volt, all the goodies in that, is getting the same upgrade. Two model US lineup gets upgrades to performance, battery capacity, range, charging speed for the new S e-tron GT and the top spec RS e-tron GT. Performance. So the S e-tron, 300 miles of range on 20-inch wheels, DC charging. You know, if you love the Taycan, all this sounds familiar. 320 kilowatt up from 280 kilowatt. A new cooling plate with so-called U-flow architecture ensures what they call homogeneous thermal transfer, permitting a maximum charging power increase. Like I say, 320 kilowatts. We've seen this on the Taycan coming to the Audi. So 18 minutes of charging. Crazy good launch control, 0 to 60 miles an hour, 2.4 seconds, almost 1,000 horsepower in this. And the slowest new RS e-tron is still quicker than the quickest previous generation. That makes sense, doesn't it? Like air suspension, an active air suspension available on it as well. The Audi RS e-tron, the e-tron itself always came after the Taycan, and I think it's understandable that many people who have a love affair with the Porsche brand would think that the Audi is, you know, a bit of the sort of ugly stepsister, but not at all. You know, it's subjective. The styling is different. Engineering very similar, but different teams engineering the vehicles. Do you think this brings, you know, Tom, do you think this brings any more attention to that vehicle? Audi, of course, having, you know, a tough time sometimes engaging people on their, you know, their EV offerings in the US.
I don't know. You know, to be honest, I mean, I love what they're doing, but I don't know if it really moves the needle, Martin, to be honest with you. You know, personally, I'm not quite sure that this really makes that big of a difference. You know, to give you a short answer when you probably wanted a long one.
No, it's good. We can talk about really. Electric minivans, yeah. If you want.
No. I just don't know if it really makes that big of a difference for the market that's interested in those vehicles. But, you know, it's important for guy nerds like us, but I don't know if it really moves the needle for the general public.
Yeah, I feel like it's like it's just another choice. If you have, you know, if you have deep pockets and you want a sports car, electric sports car, you can go for the Taycan or you can go for the Audi now. And they both offer really amazing performance. So like the i90 Surge, which we did from that road trip nonstop from Seattle to Boston, the Taycan, if you watch the all the episodes now, was the winner by a lot. Like, it was amazing. It's amazing car for road tripping. That's I get giddy just thinking about how good that car is, and I really wish I had a chance to have a go in it for a while. But so the RS now has really stepped up with its output and performance and the battery, and so it's got all those same goodies as well. It might be a little bit more relaxed, I think, than the Taycan. It's a slightly different feeling car, but it's still, you know, I don't know if you're going to be there's a whole lot of cash savings in buying it, because these prices all went up. Like the RS GT performance, like the top one starts at $167,000, which is a lot of money. And the cheaper one, they call it the S e-tron now. I think that's a new trim. I don't remember the S from before, but yeah, it starts at $125,500, which is still like, you know, buku bucks, right? Yeah, and it's way out of my price range. I won't be buying any of these anytime soon, and most of my friends won't be. But, you know, if I see one, I'll be, you know, very happy for the person behind the wheel.
Yeah, I think they're amazing vehicles. Don't get me wrong. I hate to sound so negative. I don't know. For me, in that segment, I just don't see the Audi products as being a big, you know, really doing much. I see almost none of them on the market yet, and I don't know if improving them or making them better is going to really make that big of a difference. You know, Audi's wheelhouse is in that $50,000 price range. You know, that's what they need to really get electric Audis on the road. They got to be in that, you know, $45,000 to $65,000 price range with a, you know, long range fast charging electric vehicles, and they've been doing a good job with that. I just, the top end models don't, you know, I don't know. That's not what I focus on. That's not what excites me. Don't get me wrong, I love driving them, but you know, we've almost have too many, you know, 100,000 plus electric vehicles that, you know, so few people can relate to and connect to. I almost don't even want to spend time talking to them. I know they're fun and we have to talk about all this in the industry, but you know, people can't connect to that, you know, and it's kind of like, how many $125,000, $150,000 EVs do we need on the market? But we just keep getting more of them.
Yeah, I was quite pleased to see VW this week talking about, they always said, like, you know, you think that the Taycan and the e-tron are good, you wait until Project Trinity. That's our next greatest platform, the car, whatever it was coming out, 2025, got delayed and delayed and delayed. And they're saying this week, Project Trinity, whatever car that ends up being, is going to be more like 2032, because they're going to divert resources into making an electric Golf. And that news can't make me happier as someone who loves VW, not only the brand, but, you know, the work that they do, and we want to see them survive and thrive. And just talking absolute sense, like, you have these nameplates in your locker that you've been building up over 7 or 8 different marks, you know, you got golf in there, you got Passat, maybe whatever means a lot to you, polo or anything like that, or Tiguan or etc. And please just lean into those, make electric versions of those. They're saying that they're going to make the electric Golf further towards the end of the decade, yes, but using the Rivian technology, the zonal architecture, brings the cost down, speeds up production of, typically it can be 48 months to get a new vehicle to market. They're bringing it down to maybe 30 months and even less at Volkswagen. And look, some of the Chinese names can do it in 15 months, depending on what the vehicle is and the market that it's aiming for. So all of that is all good stuff. And I'm more excited about talking about an all-new electric Golf using the Rivian technology inside it than a very expensive sports car. But at least we have those cars on the market now. And VW has done a lot of jam tomorrow, which is like, oh, yeah, but you wait for the next thing. And it's like, okay, well, you've got to bring something at some point. Also good to see that the ID Buzz has begun its deliveries, I think, November 21st. US dealers, just over a week ago, I didn't mention this last week on the show, were getting deliveries of the Buzz. So not that I've seen or heard. I don't spend a lot of time on social media. Maybe they're even with customers now. We know the first customer was a famous comedian who's like a big ID VW van fan, Gabriel Iglesias. I haven't heard of him, but he's got 4.6 million Instagram fans, so he's very famous. And but I think, you know, normal buyers should get that. So again, that's, let's celebrate that, because that's a great vehicle to get to the US later than it should have been. Yes, admittedly, but it's there now. So I joked about talking about electric minivans, but why not an all-electric version of the Pacifica? According to Chrysler CEO Christine Fuel, the electric minivan would bear the Pacifica name. Good. It's a name that you've got. The people have had ones before. They've got brand loyalty. Don't throw away all of your brand loyalty, established car companies, because, heck, you've got the name in your locker. Use it. And they will use Pacifica for an all-EV version. And there is a refresh coming out in 2026. No details yet on when the EV Pacifica will be coming. But hopefully that and a plug-in hybrid version would coexist, be perfect. You can pick and choose your powertrain. And I don't know, what is the Pacifica sort of brand seen as in the US? You know, Tom, I presume that this is just a big mainstream name, that if it was all EV, family utility vehicle, that could be a big sales hit.
Well, the Pacifica is Chrysler now. That's the... still on the vehicle left in the lineup. And if it wasn't for Pacifica, they probably would have shuttered the brand, because Chrysler minivans have, you know, like kind of invented the minivan. It was like the first really successful one, and they've always sold well. Now, I haven't checked the last couple of years, but they always dominated this segment. So it was worth like keeping the brand just for the minivan, Martin. And I've always enjoyed driving them. I always thought, for whatever reason, they had the secret sauce, you know, and you know, I thought that after a few years, the Toyotas and the Hondas and the competitors would do a better job. But then Chrysler came out with their next generation minivan, and I'd get in, I'd say, you know what? They did it again. And then the next generation came out, and I said, you know what? They did it again. And when the plug-in hybrid came out, I remember at the first auto show, sitting in it and being like, this thing's, it's incredible. The only negative that it, because where the battery was, it lost their stow and go seating, where the seat easily flips down and goes into the floor. And I thought that was a big hit. But other than that, I was like, I would love driving. This could be my everyday vehicle. You know, they really made a good vehicle. So, that's, you know, in the US, like the minivans, it had been historically the Chrysler Pacifica was like the minivan. So if they do a good job with the all electric one, you know, I think that, that'll be good. I think they did when the plug-in hybrid Pacifica first launched, they did have problems. They had problems with the bed. They were recalled a couple of times. There was stop sales in the beginning. I know three or four of them. But that's going back. This, it came out in like 2017, I think, right, Tom? Year it sold.
That sounds about right. Yeah, it doesn't have hasn't had a great reputation for reliability in the plug-in hybrid version.
So, So that's hurt it. But when it's working, it's a good vehicle. I follow a member of the Facebook groups, the Plug-in Hybrid Pacifica Facebook groups, and they all talk about their fuel economy and so forth. You know, I'm averaging 60 miles per gallon with a big full-size minivan hauling the kids around. Making it electric would be great.
I need to check out that group. Pacific has been off my radar. I really didn't realize it was a big seller, so I just looked up. Last year in 2023, they sold 120,554, 20% of which were plug-in hybrids. So those are good numbers. So yeah, I like the sounds of this idea of, you know, making the Pacific electric. Being old like I am, I was thinking, you know, like the Chrysler Caravan would be the nameplate to really kind of, you know, carry a minivan for them. But with these kind of numbers and being more recent, I think Pacifica actually is probably the right decision. But yeah.
No, it's interesting. Looking through the comments of this, you know, an electric minivan could be one of those things that sells really well. It could be one of those things they need to put both powertrains on the market at the same time and see how it sells. Speaking of which, we in the next 5 minutes, just over, we should be joined by the head of product marketing from Scout Motors. They will have both options, an extended range and all-electric version of this Scout Traveler and Terror. We thank him for joining us for the last half an hour of today's podcast as we wrap up the news of the week. Over here, because we don't have the Pacifica, but we do have vehicles that can ferry people around, which I'm guessing probably... would be a bit, kind of analogous to that. So not the sexiest of brands. So we have Peugeot, the E5008. That's a big three-row, all-electric, 100-kilowatt-hour battery, 400 miles of range, and not fabulously expensive. And so, again, no one's going to grow up one day I'll have a Peugeot E5008. But three rows, big space, perfect for families. I've not driven that yet. I'm looking forward to driving it. Hopefully, it will live up to everything that we expect to see from those vehicles. But there's big family vehicles that just do a job. So important, aren't they? So important. Not particularly sexy, but, you know, very important to do a job. How long have we got? Let's do six more minutes of news, and then we can...
We could talk about another pickup truck coming, possibly. Or not really, actually. I don't know. Do you want me to talk about this?
Oh, the Hyundai and GM tie-up.
Yeah.
This looks interesting. Tell us more about it.
So, yeah, Hyundai and GM are talking. I guess Mary Barra was over there in early November and talking about pursuing a joint development of a pickup truck aimed at Latin American markets, among other things they were talking about. So the two, they're considering just like a badge engineering kind of approach. So where vehicles produced by Hyundai Motor under the GM symbols would be, or GM producing vehicles under the Hyundai, you know, emblem would be sold, and they could, you know, use their different sales channels in whatever countries like they have their more strength, I guess. I don't know if they'd be competing against each other so much, but yeah. But looking at Latin American markets, like a world kind of truck, which I don't know. I feel like this is interesting news. Like, got my attention because, you know, I imagine it would be smaller than a full size American truck, which is attractive to me and probably to a lot of other people around the world. But the timing of it, I don't know, because they're just talking about this now. So it would take, you know, what 2030 before anything could ever happen. And I just feel like right now there's a lot of Chinese companies making a, you know, big run on Latin American markets. Like, they're really pushing so Chinese car companies are, you know, producing way more cars than they can sell in China. So they're just offloading them overseas and developing markets as much as possible. Like, Mexico has got a huge influx of Chinese cars over the last few years. A lot of those are gas cars. I just found out, I think yesterday, which I hadn't really realized, but yeah, they're really developing these for other markets. They've been in a number of different, like Colombia, they've been in there for years, BYD has, and other companies. Anyway, so I just feel like it's going to be super competitive, and Chinese automakers have pickup trucks as well themselves now. So I mean, if they could, I'd say they should try it. I think they should go for it because they need to compete on the world stage. But they really need to kind of look at who they're competing against and make sure they can bring good value for money with whatever they end up, you know, making. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. The truck market, you're right, is different to the US truck market for the kind of global vehicles. And there's some electric ones as well. This week we saw in Australia the BYD Shark 6, which had 4,000 pre-orders, and I think half of that in the first 48 hours is certainly going to give, you know, the Toyota Hilux, Ford Ranger reason to sit up and pay attention. I mean, like, oh wow, like that's Australia, not the world's biggest car market. You know, 4,000 of those, which will be coming not now before the end of the year, but that'll be in January now. And that's Australia. You know, that's just a very decent. Of course, it's a Ute because that's what they'll call it. But you know, very capable, decent sized Ute in Australia. So yeah, I think people are happy to try new things. Although I guess Tom, you know, in the US at least. Truck culture, you know, if you've had several trucks and maybe your dad and your granddaddy had the same, you get more wedded to a brand, don't you? Or is the move to EV, you think, shredding all of that?
Not yet in the truck market yet. I don't think it's shredding the brand loyalty just yet. It will, I think, as more people accept electric trucks. But you're right on, Martin. There's a lot of brand loyalty here. Truck wise, you know, it takes somebody's had four or five Fords in a row. It takes a lot to move them into a Chevy and vice versa. And, you know, we get that brand loyalty. It seems more so with pickup trucks than with passenger cars. You know, it's interesting. You've got your Ford guys, your Chevy guys, and the Dodge Ram has made huge inroads over the last 10 years. With becoming, you know, taking a bigger piece of that pie. One more thing before we get Scout to come on, I think we might have a minute or so. I mentioned last week that I was going to be putting out the connector video with, that's the meter collar system that allows you, if you have a small service, to still charge your electric car. Earlier in the show, we were talking about the GM's vehicle-to-home energy system and cost and so forth. If you watch the video that I put out towards the end when I'm talking to Will Fulton, the founder of Connector, he talked about they're developing a product now that's that same small meter collar that is an entire vehicle-to-home system. So you potentially, I know John Check was talking earlier about cost. You know, there's a potential to be able to buy this small of meter collar that is, you know, $1,000 or so, and that would have your whole vehicle to home system. The only thing you would need is a bi-directional charger to connect to the vehicle. Of course, we need to have industry standards so all vehicles would be able to use it, because this wouldn't be a Ford system or a GM system that specifically could work with Ford's vehicles or GM's vehicles. We are getting close. Yeah, if you're watching on YouTube, that's all it would look like. And that would be the whole vehicle to home system right there. We are getting close here in the US to having fully defined standards for vehicle to home integration. So I think once that happens, we're going to get some pretty cool solutions and connectors working on that. They believe in the next year to year and a half, they'll have a fully functioning system like that. That's just a simple meter collar. And that's what the founder of Connector, and we talk a little bit about that towards the end of his interview, that's their next project that they're working on. But imagine that, you know, you've seen how big the Ford and GM systems, and I know Tesla's done a lot to reduce the size of the system, but it's still much bigger than a little meter collar like that. That basically you pull the meter off, you slap this thing on and pop the meter back on top of it, and you've got a whole home vehicle-to-home integration kit.
All right.
You're on mute, Martin.
I was just saying fantastic. I was just simply showering it with praise. But yeah, that's good news. Go check out Tom's videos that he's had out this week on that technology on the new 100,000 plus YouTube channel. If you missed the start of the show for Tom's State of Charge channel. All right, just gone 1:30. We can now welcome our very, very special guest to the podcast this week. Been getting loads of comments I can see in the live chat about having Scout Motors on. Head of Product Marketing is, well, first of all, let me say your name correctly. Is it Shaheen Karimian?
That's great, Martin. Thank you. Nice to see you.
Let's be respectful, first of all. Thank you so much for joining us live on the show this week. A ton of people in the comments can't wait to ask you questions as well. We'll kick off, you know, with a couple as well. Right after the Scout launch, you showed the world your baby, which you've been working on in secret for so long. We got to see those vehicles. Armchair critics like us got to pass our opinions. How did the team feel immediately after that reaction to the Traveller and the Terror?
It's been incredibly positive. I mean, you got a group of people that started as a super scrappy small team some 2 years ago and has grown to 700 Scouts working in offices across Novi, Michigan, Blythewood, South Carolina, building out a factory. And to see such a positive reception to the product and to see such validation of things like a very carefully considered pivot to EREV vehicles, which I'm sure we'll be diving into. We couldn't feel prouder and happier about the work and how it's been received. And we know that we have a long road ahead to make sure we can deliver on all those promises we made.
Got some hardcore fans in the audience and some newcomers as well. What's the ambition of Scout Motors then? What's your North Star?
Our North Star is to, at the highest level, make the next generation of rugged vehicles for the American market. Within that, there's certain aspects that are quite clear from our reveal. We want to sell the Traveller and the Terror. We want to offer a configuration, a variety of energy systems. We want to offer a direct sales environment and bring trust and enthusiasm back into the automotive purchasing process here in America. So a couple North Stars, but the biggest one is launching Scout and everything that Scout stands for.
Well, the other two guys on the podcast, you can tell I'm over here in, you know, not a million miles away from London in the UK, but our guys, our co-hosts on the podcast today, Tom and Dominic, both truck owners at the moment. Tom, obviously multiple truck owner. When you saw the, unfortunately from a distance, Tom, for various reasons, you had to cancel it at the last minute. Tom, when you saw those vehicles, did they put Scout on your shopping list, and what would you like to talk to Shaheen about?
Yeah, so for sure, I think that they look great. First, Shaheen, thanks for coming on. Appreciate you taking the time here this morning.
Nice to see you again, Tom.
Absolutely are on my radar. I wish you were bringing them to market a little bit sooner. I have to admit, I would get a little bit more excited. There's so many things happening in this industry, and things happen so quickly. When things are a few years out, it's hard for me to really jump in and be like, yeah, here, take my money right now, because you just don't know where we're going to be in a couple of years. But I do think that you guys nailed a lot of things and did a lot of things right. And I was so disappointed that I couldn't make it to the initial unveil. I had to cancel the night before with some family things that came up. But yeah, no, I have a lot of questions, but we love show interaction here on Batteries Included. So, you know, what I really want to do is take a look in the comment section and see what everybody else wants to know. If I could start off, I would probably start off with the reasoning for the design of the charge port with the 110 volt outlets all in row, like right under the charge port. That was one of the things that struck me as a little odd. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the thought behind that.
Yeah, the charge port concept as shown in October, that is sort of the premise of, let's put all of the work capability in one outlet of the vehicle. So if you need bi-directional charging through the NACS port, if you need to offboard power through the 110, it's provided there. On the pickup, it's inside the bed. I don't know if you saw that as well. That was the thinking as presented.
Okay. I was just wondering, any concern about if the charge port's open because I'm plugging in 110 volt outlet, I'm at a work site or something and I'm powering stuff. It looks like water could get into the next port. Is that maybe just the angles that I'm looking at? Do you, I know some J1772 and CCS1 vehicles have like a plastic cover, which people hate. And I actually hate it too. But for this instance, where you might have a charge port open and no connector tethered to it, would you need something like that, you think?
There could be a case for a small plastic cover like that. But Tom, I think what I'm gathering from the question is, like, in a future state, would there be a concern that a charge port could get wet and it would lead to customer issues? In our development process, we would not allow that to happen. So these vehicles will be at job sites. They'll be tested off-road. We'll check all of our own thinking and premises in, on that front. So in the engineering arc, we'll ensure that there's no sort of concern about water intrusion going into a charge port. That's a big water intrusion to charge ports is actually a very crucial decision on where we've placed USB-C and 110 throughout the vehicle. And do you make the one in the front trunk waterproof? Do you make the ones in the rear cargo area of the SUV waterproof? They're all engineering and cost trade-offs that are very carefully considered.
Has anything changed on the timeline since the announcement? And can you remind us what the timeline is?
Initial production in 2027, and we're still very much on track for that.
Amazing. Sweet. That's great news. Great news to hear. How should people think about Scout? A niche brand or with ambitions to be more of a volume manufacturer?
A brand with ambition. We wouldn't be putting all this work into a $2 billion factory. We wouldn't be doing groundbreaking. We wouldn't be showing these vehicles, I think, with the confidence that we're showing them if we didn't have ambition. We are definitely looking to be a major player in automotive, and especially in these segments that we've talked about so far, being rugged SUV and full-size truck. But we'll see where we go from there.
So the factory you're building in South Carolina, I understand that's going to have a capacity for 200,000 vehicles. So are your ambitions like that big or possibly bigger?
Let's fill one factory and go from there.
Okay. Right?
Yeah. What we don't want to be is one of these brands that's showing you, like, oh, we're going to do a rugged SUV and a truck. And then 6 months from now, you're going to hear from us talking about another segment. And 6 months from then, we're going to talk about another segment. We want to show up in the right way and deliver what we've promised and earn our way up.
Right. We had a question here from Lon Domes. Can we get clarification on the mentions? There was some confusion, I think, at the rollout about the size of it. But I had reached out to Scout myself, and they sent me over these ones, so I'm just popping them up on the screen
Those are accurate. So length of the Traveler SUV with the spare tire carrier is 207.9 inches. I believe a graphical difference in one of those outlines was being misinterpreted. Right. So we clarified that as quickly as we could. Length without the spare tire carrier is 190.9 inches, and then width of the body without mirrors is 79.9 inches, which is right underneath the FMVSS class that requires clearance lights. Doesn't mean we can't do a vehicle that'll be wide enough to require those clearance lights in the future, which is, of course, a very fun, playful place to be as an off-road brand. But the dimensions that you posted are accurate, and I would run with those for any questions.
I had a quick question about the extended range, as I'm sure you know we're going to talk about, and the EREV versions. You know, the EV world is moving at breakneck speed. It is perhaps 10 years old if you look at mainstream vehicles like the Tesla Model S, Nissan Leaf, Renault Zoe over here. You know, the combustion industry is, you know, more than 100 years old in terms of the time it's had to get things right. So it's understandable that things change, and they change really quickly in EV world. We've seen lots of the other big, particularly, you know, OEMs, Detroit OEMs, talking about the need to, maybe look a bit more hybrids because the EV move hasn't happened as quickly as we thought it might do. So everyone's trying to predict the future. It's massively hard to do. Was the idea of doing an extended range vehicle always part of the plan, or are you having to try and read this massively changing landscape as quick as possible, and did that come in later, or where did that fit into your plans?
Yes and yes, and I'll go from there to say there was a pivot to consider EREV. Was it on day one 2 years ago? No. Was it two nights before the reveal? Also no. since late last year, since early this year, we've been making very careful considerations. I think there's a lot of disappointing political tie-ins to the energy choice within a vehicle that sort of challenges the public's perception of this. But where I always land is customers have said they like them. And customers have also said they like them in gas vehicles. Because when you look at your average, mid-size, crossover, semi-premium brand thing. What have they all been doing? Turbocharged engines for low-end torque, quiet NVH, instantaneously shifting transmissions, and digital connected ecosystems. That sure sounds a lot like an EV to me. Customers like front trunks. They like a quiet driving experience. They like instant torque. But there are questions around how do I make this vehicle work for my lifestyle? And that's where we've come in, where we believe the EREV pivot that we've done with the Harvester, it gives you the benefits of EV. You're still getting a front trunk. You're still getting one pedal driving and great instant torque from electric drive units. But you are freeing your lifestyle to not be dialed into just charging infrastructure. You can refuel anywhere that a fueling station, arguably in America, is built, being a charge station or a gas station.
Interesting. And Sheen, have you guys released, and forgive me if you haven't, I just haven't picked it up yet, like percentages of reservations on pure BEV and EREV vehicles?
We're talking about the split between SUV and truck, which is about 70-30. We have not released the energy system split. And quite frankly, Tom, like, it's a moment in time. And over time, as we get closer to SOP, that number could change. So we want to make sure that we're building and sharing numbers that are accurate and representative of where we'll be when SOP comes. If we were to give you a figure on that today and it changes, it skews a bunch of the thinking. But we know that, like, the lifestyle choice of SUV or truck is much more critical to the customer before they get to that energy systems choice. There's also some great customer forums that have been aggregating their order data, which I'm sure you've seen, and some great commentary from Scout reservation holders.
Yeah. So at the moment.
I'm curious about this. I really am curious about how the recent push to EREVs and plug-in hybrids seems to be, you know, the soup du jour. And I fully believe that that was fueled by an inadequate infrastructure of high-speed electric vehicle chargers and the right chargers, let's say, for trucks to be able to have pull-through chargers and so forth. I'm real curious to see if that goes away. You know, I fully believe that the EREV and the plug-in hybrid wave of today that seems to be all the rage is going to be short-lived. And, you know, by the end of this decade, people are going to say, you know, well, why would I want to put that thing on my vehicle? I don't need it. And you know, these are, people are going to be, have cars that are only 2 or 3 years old. And they're gonna decide that, you know, they should have went full BEV. Just my opinion. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. I think it all relies on infrastructure, and we've got companies like IONNA coming out now. There's a lot of money getting dumped into the that area right now with lighting up the country with high speed charging. I really do believe that once we have a real comprehensive nationwide network of reliable high-speed charging equipment, that the EREV technology is going to be something that is like, you know, we don't need this. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And that really wasn't a question for you, unless you want to comment on your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I do, Tom. And if you look at the world simply, or the automotive world simply, within three buckets of pure ICE, some form of hybridization, and pure BEV, what I feel like I see in the market is this V-shaped curve where ICE is now integrating. We thought it was going to be ICE goes away, BEV takes off. And there's an explicit inflection point where this changeover happens. But what it feels like is happening is ICE is grabbing hybrid and saying, hybrid, please keep us around as long as possible. Please optimize us to every last drop of fuel and a bit of energy density we can get from a drop of fuel. And then BEV is saying, oh, hybrid, please help us take off. Please be the training wheels we need to get this technology in customers' hands, get them the experiences. And there's this moment where HEV, PHEV, EREV, these acronyms will come. And we do believe they offer great customer value to help get them into this place of preparedness and get them familiar with the technology. And then we'll still see a very BEV strong future. I don't believe we'll see a regression. It's a personal anecdote away from full BEV with a significant share of the market, because customers have said they like them. You can't have that many vehicles out there in the world now and they just disappear. And as always, I think almost every charging infrastructure conversation is disclaimed with ICE has had a 100-year head start on gas stations.
Yeah, completely. So, you're amongst friends here. We're all super interested in getting into the weeds on this. So just tell us from behind the scenes, really. So if we're aiming at 2027, even if it's a 28 model year, what happens right now within Scout? What's the path to production looking like? What are you doing today? What's happening behind the scenes, and what are you guys working on? Just tell us how these cars come to life.
Yeah, I mean, it's an accelerated automotive development path for sure. And some of those questions are, what do we digitally simulate? What can we do without a physical prototype? What do we need a physical prototype for? Which proving grounds are we going for? If we have a challenge schedule at the end of next year that we can forecast now, do we need to go to New Zealand to do some winter testing? Do we need to plan for some hemispherical efficiencies of how we test these vehicles and get them out there in the world at the right time to get all the testing done that we need to get done? We're making decisions on how to do the homologation path for the EREV. I've seen some of these questions already fly by of, will the EREV have one pedal or two pedal driving? How much fuel is there in reserve for the EREV versus how much is BEV range? These are all questions that we need to now fine tune the concept. We have high level targets, but getting down in the nitty gritty of, as we develop the hardware of these vehicles, the body on frame platform, as well as the bodies themselves, we just have to flesh out every last detail. So right now we've asked ourselves, I think, every question we can ask ourselves, and soon it will be, what are the surprises that come up and how do we solve for those surprises?
Excellent. What's it like working within the background of having obviously Volkswagen Group as Rivian have now found out, like that big name behind you makes a massive difference, but also being agile and nimble and being the separate group of people. I've not heard you call yourself Scouts before. It's really nice and super good. And we heard on stage, I think at one of the tech conference, like Verge or something, the new co-CEO of the joint venture, Wassim Bansay, talking about how Scout will be able to use this zonal architecture that's coming, you know, via Rivian and with the joint partnership with the Volkswagen JV. And then, of course, we had that big announcement probably a couple of weeks ago where it all became, you know, more formalized. So what's it like working within having that big almost backstop of, not to be crude, but a parts bin, but also working within a kind of smaller, agile, quicker team?
Yeah, so there's a couple points there, some about company structure and some about how we all work together and the culture of these companies and also what resources are available to us. I'll start with Scout is an independent company that's funded by Volkswagen. We are not a subsidiary brand. We are our own company. What that's led to is sort of a really cool dynamic where you've got people working independently in offices across America with the support of Volkswagen where needed. So when it comes to the parts bin aspect, I think there's a lot of automotive folks excited to have these conversations of where's the secret Volkswagen inside the Scout, or now where's the secret Rivian inside the Scout? And I can confidently tell you the Scout is a Scout. Where those efficiencies lie is a window regulator, some bracket underneath a seat, a seat power motor. These are the things where, is it robust? Has it been crash tested? Has it been designed for cost efficiency? Yes, yes, yes. All right, let's call wherever that lies in the portfolio and say, we'd like to use this part. Where are the parts of the vehicle that are customer facing, like displays or an architecture? We're excited to be on this incredible zonal architecture coming to market through the joint venture. And Wassim is a really smart guy. I used to work with him in my past life where I met Tom. So it's really cool to see all this technology available to Scout, and we can then go to all these various portfolios and make the decisions of what fits our price point, what fits our customer.
A little earlier, we were talking about the new Audi RS e-tron, which is Audi is a Volkswagen brand. So, and we were talking about the battery in the press release. They mentioned the new just a cooling loop or something. So we raced the Porsche Taycan across the country a few weeks back. And it beat everyone. And part of the reason it did that is because its thermal management is just really good. It's above, you know, this better than anybody else's. Can you bring that sort of technology to Scout, or is that kind of complicated? Do you have to work out your own completely independent sort of system for that kind of thing?
So I don't want to make any assumptions about maybe deep level intellectual property that maybe belongs to another company, but there are benefits of having some of those learnings available. We may be able to ask for a consult or a perspective and reach into, again, the portfolio of parts available to us. We are going to have an 800 volt architecture. We do know that 800 volt architecture needs to perform in pretty extreme environments, being at a job site or in an off-road environment like Moab or all the usual suspects that I'm sure many of you have been on throughout various press drives or personal endeavors. So we'll be testing that in our own way. And I would sort of think to, why is the Taycan so good at thermal management? Because it's a sports car. Why is it a great sports car? Because Porsche developed it. What does Porsche do in their development cycle? They probably take it to some racetracks and test those most extreme conditions and then find a way to amortize the best balance of that technology throughout most use cases. So hopefully in this coming couple years, you will see prototypes and get access to vehicles that show a similar thinking when it comes to provide for that best edge case and then find a way to amortize that great experience across normal use cases without hurting the customer being in experience.
So shifting gears a little bit, Shaheem, how confident are you that you guys are going to be able to pull off being your own brand and sell direct to customers? Because I know that's the plan, but we all know how strong NADA is and the dealer lobbies here in the US, and they are going to come at you guys full on, like they just went after Ford, and Ford didn't even try to really sell direct. They tried to kind of sell direct or help their customers have set pricing. You know that the dealers are going to come after you and say, wait a minute, you just can't change a name here. You're Volkswagen. You got to sell at Volkswagen dealers.
Yeah. In terms of confidence, Tom, I work at the company and I'm very excited to work at the company, and I wouldn't be putting energy in something I didn't believe in. So on a personal level, I feel good about it. From a terms and conditions perspective, I think that you might be looking for. Again, that's where the benefit of Scout Motors comes in. We are an independent company building what's right for our customers first and foremost. We're going to be having that connection with them as closely as possible. And I think some of these other brands that have been referenced, they are subsidiaries of a larger brand and then operating in the region of that brand. Scout has a really incredible VP of growth, Cody Thacker. He's thinking about the customer first and foremost. A lot of our decisions are made with the mindset of a complete ecosystem. So we have great confidence in the path ahead and are looking forward to delivering on that.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. Do you think, heard that it's possible that you might use your factory to also build Volkswagen? Well, you said you're open to other brands, you know, building vehicles for anybody, but, you know, Volkswagen might be one of the companies that builds vehicles there. And I thought that my first thought to that was the dealer lobby is going to love that. You know, that's going to give them ammunition to say, wait a minute, you know, on one hand, you're saying you're not part of Volkswagen, you're making Volkswagens at your factory. And I hate to keep bringing this up, but it's a very important topic. You know, do you think if you do make Volkswagens at your factory for Volkswagen, your contract manufacturer, that would complicate your direct sales model, possibility?
Tom, on that one, I will say, if it were to happen, let's talk about it if it happens, because right now we're focused on making Scouts. Yeah,
I gotcha. And sorry to hit you with these hard questions right now, but
it's okay.
Paramount in my mind. I hate the way the dealerships have such a stranglehold, the dealer lobby on manufacturers here. So you know, it's just such a unique topic that I couldn't help but to hit you with a few questions while we had you here.
No, it's okay. And that's one of those ones where I'm actually kind of thankful to be dealing with product marketing and working in an environment where it's all the fun stuff. I sometimes feel for the folks in more challenged environments in our industry. That is a huge task to get behind and to build. The direct sales model is going to be a tough path, but we're excited to build it. And that's also one of those factors where we're not looking to bite off more than we can chew. Like, we've already taken a big bite out of the automotive market. We're building a factory. We're building a new brand. We're launching a new brand. We're developing these body on frame products in a way that's new to our teams, because we've brought people from different tribes of auto. We've got Ford, Rivian, Stellantis, all sorts of folks at our company building in this new culture together. So we're going to focus on that mission first.
And then you mentioned that you're building a factory and you're building two vehicles, but then you have to service them as well, because everything that is part of mechanical engineering will go wrong, even if they're the best built in the world. So for an independent company that's a startup, how do you even begin in a country as vast as the US? How do you even begin to sell people on the idea that if they do buy the vehicles, then service is going to be handled in a way that is, you know, is efficient and gets done? How do you work that problem out?
Yeah, there's a balancing point there too, of when you look at service, like what is service? There's wear and tear items, there's vehicle defects, there's accident repair. First, you got to bucket those all out into the right place, and then looking at what we can do in field. What could we do potentially in someone's driveway? What could we do at a service center? When do we need to bring someone to our facilities or their vehicle to our facilities? And our target is that within the launch year, there will be a Scout service center within 2 to 3 hours drive time of the majority of customer reservation holders. And we do have solid aspirations of what we can do in the field. We don't want to bring someone into a service center for something that could be as simple as a wheel and tire or wipers or preventative maintenance inspection type thing. But more details on that to come as we go to market.
So other companies have done like mobile service. So is that something, it sounds like you're considering that as well?
Definitely considering. I think you will see mobile service as part of our service ecosystem. The exact balance of how much we depend on that or utilize that to go farther reaching or maybe higher throughput in local areas to our service centers, we'll see.
So a little question I wanted to ask. And this is kind of a marketing thing, at least potentially. So we're mentioning that Scout's parent company, original company, Volkswagen, has a deal with Rivian to use their zonal architecture and the underlying software for that, which I understand that Scout will be using as well. So Scout and Rivian have a lot of similarities. They're very kind of similar kind of brands, similar products of, you know, full size. I guess Rivian's pickup truck isn't quite full size and yours is, but they're still very, very similar. They look like they're aimed at the same kind of part of the market. How are you going to differentiate yourself?
I want to address a couple points in there.
Sure.
I think similar vehicles is extremely dependent on the type of enthusiast or the type of owner, because some of the folks in the comments here, there was one gentleman saying that he's asking for three mechanical lockers. He would say a Rivian and a Scout are likely nothing alike. And I could also see the case of, if you're looking from the outside in as a potential shopper, you see saving the world for our kids, active lifestyle, outdoors brand, technology forward. And then you're seeing Scout saying ready for work and play. And so leaning into heritage, okay, there's some similarities there. But I would argue that from a product perspective, these things are actually very different. And the zonal architecture is one of those behind the scenes aspects of a vehicle. A customer isn't interfacing directly with the architecture. The customer is interfacing with your UX. How we tailor that user experience, and we've done so with a community user experience where we've talked about bringing this balance of tactile controls with the digital ecosystem. That for our customers feels like the right play. We're going to have real door handles in this vehicle that have mechanical cables going to door locks. They're not just a mechanical switch on top of an e-latch that acts like a door handle. We will have real HVAC controls. We will have real controls for that lock, for those lockers, for the gentleman in the comments. And that ties into a very snappy architecture. And that is the benefit we're providing the customer, being that balance of controls and the user experience. When it comes to the product similarities, like you see the Rivian, and it's a product that's using technology to solve so many problems for the customer. It's saying, here's your steering wheel, here's your pedals, here's the display, put the vehicle in the mode you want, we'll take it from here. Our vehicle is saying, hey, here's an underbody camera, here's a locker, here's your off-road mode. You go make the decisions you need to make to get through this trail.
So it sounds like you're saying Scout's going to be more analog, sort of in a complementary sense to the Rivian things, like maybe more capable off-road, perhaps. I mean, you got the physical lockers front and back, I think, right?
Yeah, we've got a physical locker front and rear. We've got the solid rear axle. We've got a sway bar disconnect on the front axle, double wishbone front suspension, some pretty aggressive articulation and ground clearance targets that I think the competitive set that we've benchmarked will really satisfy those off-road enthusiasts, the scout enthusiasts. But also, you have to remember, not everyone's going to take this vehicle to Rubicon. And how do we make that stuff part of our vehicle program, optional in these vehicles without punishing the base customer? And some of those decisions manifest like this spare tire carrier. That very much is optional, because there are customers that say, oh, this is an off-road vehicle. I can't have an SUV but not have a full-size spare. But we've also hearing those same people say the best configuration is a split tailgate. When you then put a spare wheel carrier on top of a split tailgate, you have this awkward compromise where maybe there's one step too many, but you also have all the benefits that those true enthusiasts want, like a full-size spare off-road, a place to sit, a place to hang out, and some easy, quick access to cargo. Oh, thanks, Mark. I appreciate your comment in the comment. But that spare tire is optional. Yeah, but that spare tire carrier is optional. That way, the base customer, when they get a vehicle with just a regular split tailgate, is happy, and only those hardcore off-road enthusiasts are going and creating that one-off experience. That was a bit lengthy, but I hope that answers the question.
It's awesome. Great. But hey, we're out of time. You are welcome back anytime on the podcast. Like I say, you're amongst friends here, and we can't wait to hear more about it. Clearly, the vehicle reveal was, you know, as a line in the sand. Is there anything on the horizon, even if I'm not asking for a date today, but is there anything that fans can kind of latch on to or look forward to, something coming at some quarter next year that is going to be the next stage of your story?
I think in the near term, folks will be able to see us at CES 2025 in Las Vegas. We'll have our vehicles there if you want to see those vehicles in person. If you want to see a little bit more about maybe some of the UX stuff and architecture stuff, we'll have something to show there. Go to scoutmotors.com, $100 reservation for a Scout Terra or Traveler, and your choice of energy system is the best way to get up to speed the most quickly. We'll be providing updates regularly to our reservation holders. We're excited for the story that we have to share going forward. We are looking to bring folks into the fold as much as possible. Let's show you how the sausage is made on this development path ahead. If there's any questions, feel free to email us, Threads us, Instagram us, X us at Scout Motors.
Can we blue sky you sometime soon?
I'll talk to the social guy about that.
Definitely need to be there. Sorry.
Yeah. But folks, thanks for having me on. Nice to see you again, Tom. Nice meeting you, Martin and Dominic. Happy to come back anytime.
Awesome. Well, that is the end of our show. You can stay with us to the end of our show. Any comments or questions for Shaheen, we can always pass them on. You can leave them in the comments below on the YouTube channel. Is probably the easiest place to do that, even if you are listening to the audio version of this while walking the dog or at the gym. If you like the show, please hit like or the thumbs up so we know that you are there, and you can hit subscribe and the bell icon for notifications. Thank you for joining us, Shaheen. Come back anytime you want to. This has been awesome. We're just warming up, but we got to go. Thank you for your time. We respect your time joining us on this day. And thank you very much for all of you watching and listening. And as always, Dom, please say ciao.
Ciao.
Take care. Bye.